Mr. Floyd died from a low level of oxygen, and this caused damage to his brain that we see, and it also caused a PEA arrhythmia that caused his heart to stop.
Have you formed an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty as to what the cause is or was for the low level of oxygen in Mr. Floyd?
Yes, I have.
Would you tell us what that is?
The cause of the low level of oxygen was shallow breathing.
Pulmonologist Dr. Martin Tobin testifying today in the trial against Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, the man accused of killing George Floyd. Tobin is one of many experts called by the prosecution this week. On Monday, they called the Minneapolis police chief. He said Chauvin's actions violated department policy.
Clearly, when Mr. Floyd was no longer responsive and even motionless, to continue to apply that level of force that in no way, shape, or form is anything that is by policy, is not part of our training, and it is certainly not part of our ethics or our values.
Minneapolis Chief of Police Madera Arredondo. Prosecutors also called Dr. Bradford Langenfeld, the ER doctor who treated Floyd and later pronounced him dead. He said Floyd died of oxygen deficiency. Well, here to recap what we've heard so far this week is Roland Martin, journalist and host of Roland Martin Unfiltered. Welcome to Press Play.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. All right. So last week, there was a lot of emotional and very passionate testimony, lots of tears on the witness stand. This week, it's mainly, well, dispassionate experts. What is your analysis so far about the effect of this testimony this week?
Well, actually, I won't call it dispassionate. I think you have to understand for the prosecution, they serve different purposes. So you did have the witness testimony that was obviously very painful, gut-wrenching to listen to those folks. But it's very methodical this week, but it's equally as gut-wrenching in that you have, look, you rarely have police officers testify against another police officer. The prosecution is doing a great job of blunting the defense at every turn. To have the expert on use of force for the Minneapolis Police Department, to have the police chief, to have the other experts, all of that is critical because we got to remember, jurors in this country are loath to convict cops of crimes. And so to have other cops saying, yes, actions were wrong, yes, kneeling was wrong, yes, violated these different policies, that is extremely effective for the jury, and it makes it very difficult for the defense to respond. They're putting pressure on him to potentially even take the stand because of how effective the prosecution is laying out their case.
Right. And let's talk a little bit more about the police chief's testimony. More broadly, is he painting a picture of basically one bad apple in Derek Chauvin in an otherwise well-functioning, well-trained department?
No. His only job is to testify about Derek Chauvin. See, so this is not, well, the chief is sort of talking how great the whole department is. No, he is simply only focusing on Derek Chauvin. And so the focus for us is not on anything else but Derek Chauvin, not on any other cops, not any other police department, not any other action, just Chauvin, because he is the one on trial. Remember, they're talking to a jury. We are not the jury. We're the spectators. We're watching this. The key is, how is the jury perceiving the testimony? They matter more than any of us.
Right. And so let's talk about, there's Sergeant Jody Steiger of the LAPD. So he flew out to testify on use of force and how officers are trained and what can happen when a suspect is lying on the ground face down. Talk about his testimony, because he also gave very technical details as to how these kinds of arrests should play out.
Same thing. It's important to let the jury know what is acceptable and what isn't, and to be able to go beyond the Minneapolis Police Department, to go to Los Angeles, where they handle more of these cases than Minneapolis, you're doing that. Again, what Attorney General Keith Ellison has done in putting together this prosecution team and how they have gone about this case is probably the best I've seen in any of these cases. Look, we got to remember, very few cases we have seen a police officer go to trial in the death of someone. Sure, you had the cop who killed Laquan McDonald. You had the police officer who killed the man who was a gospel singer who shot and killed him when he pulled over in Florida. But very few of these cases. And so for the public, we rarely get to see this because very few get indicted and go to trial. And so that was important because, again, what you're doing is you're reinforcing what the Minneapolis expert said by going to an outside agency. It puts mm-hmm. the defense in a serious box.
Right. So the defense hasn't begun its side yet. It is basically just doing cross-examination of the witnesses.
Right.
How do you think the prosecution's case will change, if it will, the way the defense will carry out its side when it comes up?
It's not going to change much. The defense's strategy is going to be, can we put George Floyd on trial? Can we focus on drugs, drugs, drugs? Asking the witness just the other day, hey, can you make out what he said? I ate the drug. That's their only card they can play is George Floyd was this crazy, uncontrollable, large black man who we had no choice. But to have the experts say he was already under control, there was no need to have the knee on his neck, was crucial. And so that's really what's at play here. And so the defense, it's going to be all about George Floyd. It's going to be all about drugs. And the prosecution is going to go right back to what the experts said. The experts said this. And so that's what you're going to see. And so you already see what their game plan is. They have no other thing to focus on other than the drug use. And so they tried to establish that early on by trying to say that he died as a result of the drug use. But the ER doctor refuted that. The medical examiner refuted that. And so that's the struggle they're going to have when they begin their defense.
Right. And this is not a new tactic on the part of the defense in these kinds of cases.
No, we've seen it before because you make the person who's dead, you make the victim out to be the bad guy, and you make the police officer out to be the victim. That's their strategy. What the prosecution has done is to methodically say, no, this man's actions were completely out of bounds, and they were absolutely wrong. That's why this has been so strong and effective.
How do you think this trial is being viewed in America, and in various precincts of America? Are people paying attention to it? And if so, who is paying the most attention to it?
Well, I mean, obviously African-Americans are paying attention to it. You look at the social media chatter, but a lot of people are paying attention to it because, look, the protests that took place in Minneapolis last year after his death all across the country and the world, you had a significant number of white Americans and others who were on the front lines. Look, white America had to watch this tape and go, all right, everything black folks have been saying, we now understand. We now see it. To sit there and watch a nearly 10-minute video, to watch life squeezed out of a man's body, they had to watch that. You can't turn away. And so what the trial is now doing is reliving a lot of that, if you will. You don't have the same level of attention, of course, as you did last year with the aftermath and the protest, things along those lines. But it is a reckoning that actually was lost as a result that I think is also continuing. And it's affecting every part, public policy. It's affecting local, state, national government. It's affecting corporations. George Floyd's murder has changed a lot. More needs to change. But trust me, folks are paying attention.
Right. And so in that vein, then, aren't the prosecutors and the defense, actually, in Cross, aren't they also playing to a larger audience than just the jury?
No. The defense is. The prosecution, their responsibility is solely playing to those jurors in that box to convict Derek Chauvin. That's their total focus. Once you start playing to the cameras and to the public, you lose focus.
So in that sense, is it different than, let's say, the OJ trial?
Oh, it's not even close. And there's no comparison because you're not dealing with an entertainer. You're not dealing. I mean, look, the OJ case had race. It had sex. It had class. It had all those things, gruesome murder. You had all of that. No. This isn't even a comparison.
Roland Martin is a journalist and host of the daily online news show, Roland Martin Unfiltered. Roland, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot.
We're going to look at California's criminal justice system now, where 44,000 inmates are in jail without having been convicted. Some have been in there for years. They're waiting to go to trial. This was a problem pre-pandemic, and it's a lot worse now. Robert Lewis joins me now. He covers justice issues for Cal Matters, and he's been doing some in-depth reporting on this. Welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me.
Well, 44,000, that is a stunning number, just people waiting to be tried. How long on average are they in there?
Well, it's difficult to get the average, and it's skewed a little bit because certainly some of those individuals are going to get out very quickly. Really, the more shocking stat, I think, is that there are 1,300 unsentenced inmates statewide who've been in custody for more than 3 years. And that includes, I think it's about 330 who've actually been behind bars more than 5 years without being convicted and sentenced for a crime.
Wow. And so what are some of the reasons for that?
You know, the reasons really are myriad. If you talk to prosecutors, they put a lot of the blame on the defense teams themselves. Defendants do have a right to a speedy trial, but very often the defense attorneys will request continuances so they can spend extra time preparing a case. Some prosecutors even allege it's a strategy and that defendants know that witnesses' memories fade, evidence gets weaker over time. On the flip side, it's the defendants, defense attorneys, and advocates who say, you know, prosecutors load on these enhancements, these very serious charges, you know, in a state with the three strikes law, knowing that it's going to leave a defendant sitting behind bars for an extended period of time and really pressure a plea deal. And then, of course, another aspect of this is the judges and the courts themselves who have a responsibility to manage their calendars effectively. And there's a real question as to whether they're doing that.
Right. And so there's a lot of bureaucratic delay, shall we say, baked into the system. Are there ways that the judges could actually turn this around? Could the judges say, okay, we are going to prioritize speedy trials here? I mean, this is a constitutional issue. Defense, you don't get to delay. Prosecutors, you don't get to delay. We're going to make this happen relatively quickly.
I mean, judges do have a lot of control and power. I mean, the threat, of course, is always that there's some sort of appellate claim of ineffective assistance of counsel or some sort of claim that would get the lower level trial court judge's decision overturned. That being said, you know, there was an issue in Riverside County in, I think, the mid-2000s where they were in danger of actually having a lot of cases dismissed because they weren't able to bring them to trial quickly enough. And the state basically sent a task force. They sent a bunch of judges down there to help clear backlogs. You know, there was an issue, it's a different system, but in New York several years ago in the Bronx where the delays were so bad, they basically flooded the area with extra judges and created, I think what they called at the time, the rocket docket to really push through the cases that they could settle quickly so they had the resources and time to deal with the other cases. So, yeah, I mean, there is a lot more conceivably that the system could be doing.
Well, I imagine that some of the people who are awaiting trial are, in fact, innocent. Did you discover anyone in your research who actually had spent a long time sitting in jail for a crime that they didn't commit?
You know, there have been, you know, you see it all the time in the news. You'll see stories where someone has been acquitted after, you know, 3 years behind bars for, say, a murder charge. I interviewed a man who spent, I think it was 2 years behind bars in a gun possession case. And I think there was a gang enhancement and he was ultimately acquitted. He got out. And, you know, that's time that he's never getting back.
And what about for the victims of crimes or the relatives of crime victims who have been murdered? They also are existing in a state of limbo, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, I interviewed the mother of a 21-year-old man who was murdered in Sacramento, and she lives in Texas. She flew out for the first hearing. She flew out on the one-year anniversary and to meet the new prosecutor. She's logged into every Zoom hearing that she can, and she thinks about this every day. She's living with this case. She says she can't move on you know, to sort of the next stage of closure, of healing, with this hanging out there. And, you know, whatever justice is in her case, you know, it's probably months, if not years away. And if she's lucky, she's not going to be like this guy I interviewed in Fresno County, whose sister was murdered nearly 12 years ago. And he said to me, you know, when it happened, the law enforcement, after they made the arrest, said, oh, it'll probably be a year or two before it comes to a head. This July will be 12 years. And he said he has just lost all faith in the justice system.
Wow. This must also cost a lot, because it costs a lot to house an inmate.
Oh, absolutely. There are varying figures out there. There was a UCLA law school study recently that pegged the annual cost at about, I think it was $43,000 to house someone in the LA County jail. There's also a cost to the courts. There isn't a lot of research on this subject, but about a decade ago, there was a study that said, you know, if they were to do away with just one continuance in every felony case, it would save like $60 million a year. And again, that was a decade ago. So there is a real cost to taxpayers for delay.
And then now, I guess it's just exponentially worse since the pandemic.
Well, and that seems to be the case, although I would point out, you know, the data coming from the state is terrible. So, you know, the state court system doesn't actually know what the situation is. Once the pandemic hit, this backlog appears to have grown. You know, there were all these emergency orders that allowed for the delay of hearings, for judges to vacate trial dates, for delays in arraignment. So, you know, and I got some data from individual courthouses that sure seem to suggest this growing backlog of, you know, 30%, 50% more open felony cases at the start of this year as compared to last year. So this does seem to be a backlog that we're going to be addressing as a state for quite some time.
What about in LA and San Francisco, where there are now so-called progressive prosecutors, Chesa Boudin and George Gascon, who have promised to clear this up? Have they been successful in any way?
Well, so I interviewed Boudin, and, you know, he said when he came in, it was one of the first things he really wanted to do was address the backlog. You know, he got some headlines that he actually took a case personally himself in front of a grand jury seeking an indictment. The idea being that it's the preliminary hearing phase that can often add a lot of time. So he wanted to speed it up. He said something like 20% of the cases when he came in the door were 2 years or more old. But, you know, the pandemic has just upended many of those plans. So, you know, yes, he's trying to address the backlog. Yes, some of these progressive prosecutors are trying to, you know, cut down on enhancements and certain things that, at least according to defense attorneys and advocates, add a lot of time. But because of the pandemic, it's very unclear at this point what that impact will be and when we will really see that impact in terms of addressing the age of some of these cases.
Well, how many of these defendants are in jail or locked up because they can't make bail?
So a large percentage of the inmates that I found have bail set. Now, I don't know. It was pretty impossible to determine the numbers that are truly behind bars strictly because of bail. It's entirely possible some of them had other types of holds that would keep them. So even if they could make bail, it would, you know, keep them behind bars. But, you know, it does seem evident that there are a large percentage who are behind bars because of money, because they can't afford to get out.
Even though the California Supreme Court ruled that people cannot be held solely because of that?
Well, so that's, you know, that decision didn't just automatically fling open the jailhouse doors and let everybody out. You know, the attorneys that I talk to say that it's going to be a process whereby, you know, defense attorneys have to file motions for reconsideration. There's going to have to be a process whereby judges, you know, relook at some of these bail decisions. And there's a lot of ambiguity or questions left unanswered by that decision, which, you know, while advocates are happy about it, you know, judges can still consider public safety. There's still some open questions about the degree to which judges can consider prior failures to appear and whether or not a defendant is going to show back up in court. So, yeah, I mean, going forward, I think there is a big hope that this will address some of the issue, but it certainly didn't fling open the doors for these thousands and thousands of unsentenced inmates who've been behind bars for more than a year.
Well, Robert, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. That's Robert Lewis. He's from CalMatters, and you can read his big investigation. It's called Waiting for Justice at our website, kcrw.com. Coming up, why more young people are developing eating disorders now and what we should be on the lookout for. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, the pandemic has really affected our mental health. Lots of us are feeling depressed and anxious. Teenagers and young adults are especially vulnerable, and new research shows that eating disorders have jumped in the last year as more young people spent more time on screens. That research comes from UC San Francisco. Hospitalizations for eating disorders doubled at UCSF's Benioff Children's Hospital since March of last year. For disorders ranging from binge eating to bulimia to compulsive exercise. Dr. Jason Nagata is a professor of pediatrics there, where he specializes in eating disorders. Welcome to Press Play.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what is the summary of your research there and in terms of what is causing this increase in eating disorders?
Yeah, I think that there are many reasons for different people. But as you mentioned, overall, since the start of the pandemic, the number of teenagers who've been hospitalized for eating disorders has really doubled. And I think that this is actually shown nationally. The National Eating Disorders Association has also reported a doubling in the number of help calls that they've received on their phone line. I think for a lot of teenagers who have been more socially isolated because they're not able to attend in-person school, there has been distress and anxiety and even depression related to that. And actually our newest research that was just published last month found that teenagers who spend more time in front of screens, whether it's television or social media or texting or other types of screen time, actually are at higher risk of developing binge eating disorder. For more passive screen time modalities like watching television, there's more of a propensity to snack and overeat while you're not really paying attention. Or there's also a link between binge eating food and binge watching television. One thing that is kind of interesting about the pandemic is that I think a lot of teenagers have noted something they've called the quarantine 15, kind of like the freshman 15 when they go to college, where some people have noticed a gain in weight, either because they're more sedentary or they're overeating. And then that has actually led to heightened body image concerns, and many have developed eating disorders.
Can I just get a definition from you about what binge eating disorders are? Because, I mean, I think a lot of us mindlessly snack while we're watching TV. When does that cross over into being a disorder?
Binge eating disorder is really a psychological disorder that is characterized by actually overeating like an objectively large amount of food in a short period of time. And then also a feeling of a loss of control with that eating, like you can't stop yourself. But I will say that, you know, we've also seen a rise in other types of eating disorders like anorexia nervosa, where it's more restrictive eating, and have actually turned to excessive exercise. So some teenagers, especially those athletes who normally would go to practice with teams like and are not no longer able to do that, have actually started to compulsively exercise on their own. And we have teenagers who have been reporting 5-6 hours of exercise on their own.
Mm. And is that a way for them to manage their anxiety? Or is it because, I mean, obviously there's anxiety involved, but is it because they are stuck at home and they're feeling this anxiousness? Or are they also feeling like, oh, I'm binge eating, gaining this Q15, and I want to look good for when I have to go back to school?
Yeah, I think it you know, it can vary teenager to teenager, but I do think that some of them are using it as a compensatory behavior with, you know, not with maybe the perception that they've gained weight or have overeaten. And so they're using the exercise as a means to sort of purge in some ways that excessive weight gain. But I think that there are also others who just use it as a mean of control. You know, there's so much that has been lost in control during the pandemic, like school and sports and whatever. And, you know, if they can control their diet and or their exercise, it's sort of a ways of gaining control over one aspect of their life.
You're saying a lot of this is tied to screen time. Is that because they're maybe in Zoom school and they're just seeing their faces in front of them and their peers in front of them all the time and they're not, you know, that's not normal?
Yeah, I think that the link to screen time is complex because youth have so many different forms of screens that they're exposed to now. On the one hand, there's, you know, social media like Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, that youth are relying on more and more these days for socialization, especially when in-person social gatherings are, you know, not safe or not recommended. You know, many people have turned to, you know, their Instagram followers to remain connected, but a lot of those social media are really image-based, and so there's more pressure for people to appear a certain way, or there are just body image pressures, or they're just looking at other people's images, and people are, you know, producing content that often is, you know, that is filtered, and or may just be like the one best picture out of, you know, a whole photo shoot, and so it kind of gives people a distorted mm-hmm. perception of what, you know, is actually reality. But I do think that your other point about Zoom school is also a valid one. A lot of our eating disorder patients or people who have body image concerns in general have noted that having a camera on them for school all day has been really triggering in terms of eating disorders and body image concerns.
So what should parents be on the lookout for?
Yeah, I think that red flags for an eating disorder is when somebody really becomes preoccupied or obsessed with their appearance, their weight, food, or exercise in a way that worsens their quality of life. And these teenagers may start to withdraw from usual activities they enjoy with friends or family meals because of these concerns about eating. And so I do think that if some of these warning signs are popping up, parents should see their pediatrician or primary care doctor, try to have them assess and potentially get referrals.
What if you are a kid and maybe you feel ashamed of this, but you want help and you're not ready to reach out to your parents? What can you do?
Yeah, I do think that, you know, sharing with peers or if there's a teacher or counselor at school or you know, even at pediatrician visits, when you're having your annual physical or checkup, there's always time with teenagers where they have confidential time away from their parents. And so that would be a good time to talk about that. Also, the National Eating Disorders Association does have a helpline. That was the helpline that I mentioned has also had seen a doubling in their calls during the pandemic. So people are calling them for help as well.
All right. And that number is 800-931-2237, 800-931-2237. Dr. Nagata, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Jason Nagata, professor of pediatrics at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital. Coming up, another Facebook hack, should we care? And the return of the gray wolf to California.
In our folklore, wolves are big and bad and menacing. In Native American folklore, wolves are seen as brothers and companions and not as a menace at all.
That's coming up on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Facebook is embroiled in yet another data privacy scandal. It actually happened back in 2019, but we only learned about it recently after Business Insider revealed that hackers stole personal information from more than half a billion people. like their phone numbers, where they live, email addresses, and put all that info on the dark web. Cause for alarm? Yeah, sure. But after years of headlines about big data breaches, maybe you've given up on caring. Here to tell us if it's okay to tune out is Cory Doctorow. He's a novelist, journalist, and special advisor with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Hi, Cory.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
It's nice to have you back. All right, so I think a lot of people out there may listen to that and think, oh my gosh, I give up. These hacks happen all the time. I'm sure my data has been hacked a gazillion times. Should I care?
I think you really should. I think that we need to understand that these breaches are cumulative, that every time a new chunk of data goes out on the internet, bad actors use it in combination with existing breach data to find new ways to hurt you and the people that you love. That's how this Facebook breach came about. You know, they took all the phone numbers that had ever leaked onto the internet, they added them to a giant address book, joined Facebook, and said, tell me all the information about the friends who are in my address book. And that's how they stole all that data. So this is going to get worse. And I think we should be really concerned because Facebook has a really smart playbook when these breaches happen. They say, you know, all those efforts that there are to make us less powerful, less able to lock you in, to force us to compete with other people. Well, you know, this just shows that you can't afford to do that because there are all these problems with this data we've collected. And if you make us weaker, then we won't be able to protect it. So you have to make sure that we continue to be strong.
Well, obviously, they weren't able to protect it for 500 million people. As is. So.
Well, indeed. And that's the argument that's been made before, but it didn't carry over. And, you know, what's different about this moment is the scope of the threat against Facebook right now. We have the Access Act introduced in the United States last year, as well as antitrust lawsuits, multiple antitrust lawsuits brought by virtually every attorney general in every state and territory, as well as federal antitrust action, as well as the UK Competition and Markets Authority and the European Commission introducing the Digital Markets and Digital Services Act, all of which force Facebook to a greater or lesser degree to do things like divest of its subsidiaries. You know, remember, they only bought Instagram, as Mark Zuckerberg admitted, because people were sick of Facebook and going to Instagram. Mm-hmm. He was like, that's fine. Right. You can quit Facebook. I'll just buy anywhere you go to. So to force them to divest and to force them to open up to competitors so you can leave Facebook without leaving your friends behind and still talk to them using a better service, one that doesn't spy on you the way Facebook does.
Well, right. But I think that all of this, sort of getting back to the hacking and whether we should care thing, this idea of being spied on and our information being used for other purposes, I think that also feeds into this kind of helplessness that we all feel about being hacked. Because I think, and maybe I'll just speak for myself, if companies like Facebook and all the other social media companies and all the other companies we go to online are already hacking us, if you will, and using our information mm-hmm. to sell us stuff or sell it to other people, then what's the difference between that and being hacked?
Well, I think it's a good point. I mean, Facebook at least has some kind of long-term plan not to be destroyed by the federal justice system. And so they tend to be a little more circumspect. Like, they're not going to drain your bank account, but they will collect the data that will let someone else drain your bank account. And one thing to remember about Facebook's monopoly, right, about Facebook's control and the excess rents that it can extract by extracting our data, is that it uses it to make sure that the regulatory landscape is friendly to it. You know, you might ask yourself, how is it that the Europeans have a region-wide privacy bill, but we have this patchwork of insufficient and inconsistent privacy laws across the United States? Well, it's in part because Facebook spends an awful lot of money, the money that it reaps by not taking care of our data, to lobby for weaker penalties in the event that it loses control of our data. That's the vicious cycle. It's a bit like the climate crisis, right? You know, we've got all this carbon that's in the atmosphere, and maybe we'll manage to sequester some of it, but really it's a fact, not really a thing that we can change. What we can stop is the emission of more carbon. And what we can do is head off the giant energy companies that insist that nobody but them knows as much as they do about carbon and its issues. So they should be in charge. Exxon and so on should be in charge of any kind of climate response. You know, Facebook created this problem, but they're not qualified to solve it. You know, you can't solve a problem like Facebook with Facebook. And we're at a moment where we can make them weaker and where we can do things like get meaningful privacy laws that will stop future would-be Facebooks from being mm-hmm. as reckless as Facebook has been in gathering our data. And to do that, right. we have to cut the supply lines to the surveillance industry. We have to stop them from making all the money they're making now by spying on us and handling our data so badly.
Well, California has a privacy law. Has that been effective?
So California's privacy law is good, but not great. It lacks one really important feature that I think its architects saw they would not be able to get through because of industry opposition, which is the private right of action. That means that when you're harmed, you get to sue. The way that the California privacy law is structured, you have to get the attorney general or a district attorney or someone else in government to take up your case. And that makes it really hard, right? And it also means that these companies, when they're thinking through the consequences of doing something reckless and harmful, they weigh in the balance the likelihood that someone like you or me will be able to interest some district attorney or attorney general into taking up their cause. Whereas if you had 1-800 lawyers up and down the five with bulletin boards saying, did Facebook lose your data? Call me and I'll get your statutory damages. You can bet that Facebook would be a lot more circumspect about what it collected, how long it retained it for, and how it mm-hmm. handled it.
Okay, so what can we do? Let's say we were one of those 500 billion people who were hacked on Facebook. What can we do about it?
So look, I think that, you know, 40 years ago, there were people who thought that they could solve problems individually because there was a lot of competition in the market. You know, if you didn't like the way one car manufacturer did business, you could boycott them and go to another car manufacturer. But the web is five giant websites filled with screenshots of the other four. And you personally can't change it. You need to be part of a movement. There, mm-hmm. there is no boycott or individual decision you're going to make that's going to change this. Just like no matter how attentive you are to your recycling, you're not going to head off climate change. We need systemic change, not individual action. So become part of the system. Organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation have affiliate groups, including many in Los Angeles, the Electronic Frontier Alliance, that work on this issue. The major political parties, in a rare moment of bipartisan consensus, both have wings that are advocating for limits on big tech for very different reasons. But you know what? I'll take that win wherever I can get it. There is an opportunity right now to be part of a systemic response to surveillance and big tech and monopoly more broadly. You know, it's not just tech that has a monopoly. There's only one company in America that makes glass bottles at any scale, and that's been a huge bottleneck in our vaccine distribution. And one company controls all the eyeglasses worldwide. One company controls all the professional wrestling in America. So there are people who care about monopoly in lots of ways and for lots of reasons. And once we figure out that we're all on the same side, that if you're angry that there's only two major brewers left, and I'm angry that all my professional wrestlers are begging for pennies to die with dignity in their 50s of their work-related injuries on GoFundMe because Vince McMahon has reclassified them as contractors, took away their health insurance, we're on the same side as the people who are angry about a Facebook breach. So we need systemic responses, anti-monopoly responses, and you do that through organizations.
All right. One of them being the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where you are an advisor. Cory Doctorow, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and that's EFF.org.
Coming up, how one female wolf made her way to California, attracted a mate, and created a pack of wolves for the first time in about, 100 years. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, nearly a century ago, the last gray wolf in California was killed. But recently, in 2015, a female wolf was spotted in Lassen County. That's near the northeast corner of the state. She likely traveled hundreds of miles to get there. And since then, she found a mate. He wandered down from Oregon. And she's given birth to a few litters. Slowly, the two animals are revitalizing California's gray wolf population. For environmentalists, the return of the gray wolf is a cause for celebration. But for ranchers in Lassen County, well, they are not celebrating. Journalist and author Richard Grant wrote about this for the Smithsonian Magazine, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Hi there.
Well, let's talk about how this female wolf got to Lassen County in the first place. Where did she come from?
Yeah, it's quite a story. We don't know the precise details, but we know from DNA analysis that she has half-siblings in Wyoming. And when she was a year old, she took herself on this... she was dispersing from her natal pack, looking for territory, looking for a mate. And she started basically heading towards the sunset and kept going for at least 800 miles and possibly a lot further if she came through Idaho until she wound up in Lassen County, California.
And she thought, well, here's where I'm going to find my man.
I think she was probably more interested in the fact that there were deer around, and there was if she came across the Great Basin, there was shade, there was water, there was deer to hunt, there was and there were also a lot of sheep and cattle.
Yeah.
And then by chance, a young male wolf wandered into the same territory from southern Oregon, and they got together.
And this guy who came from Oregon, he was a little bit of a celebrity, right?
He was the son of a celebrity. Oh. His father was a wolf called OR7. And OR7 was an Oregon wolf, and he went on this gigantic walkabout down through Oregon and California. And since he was radio collared, he kind of became a celebrity. People were following his travels. His journey took him on over about 4,000 miles of California and Oregon, and then he ended up meeting a female in southern Oregon, and they founded a pack, and then one of their sons became the Lassen County male.
I see. So these two, the wolf that came down from Oregon and the female who traveled maybe 800 miles or more from the Northern Rockies, they settled down and had several litters. So now how many wolves are there?
It's a little hard. They're just the latest count is a little confusing. They were up to 15 wolves in the pack, but they've now dropped that number of the pack to 7, which probably means that the pack has split into two packs. But we're a little short of solid information on that. And we know that some of the Lassen pack dispersed back into Oregon. So there's basically, there's some traffic, there's some wolf traffic. In fact, somebody just told me this morning that there's an Oregon wolf down in Monterey County.
Oh.
And people are saying that he's looking for love in all the wrong places, because as far as we know, there's no wolves anywhere near Monterey County. But they go on these extraordinary journeys, these yearling wolves, or some of them do.
And they just walk by themselves? I mean, or trot, I should say.
Yeah, they mostly travel at night. They are pretty careful about keeping themselves hidden from human beings. And they will, I mean, they can go 20 miles without breaking stride and cover 50 miles in a day or night. They're travelers.
Well, I'm wondering, were wolves native to California at one point? Or were they introduced?
Wolves were native to California originally. I think they were there for about 17,000 years. And then they got wiped out in the 19th century. This was part of an extermination campaign that was across the whole U.S. Basically, Euro-Americans almost succeeded in making the gray wolf extinct in North America. There were just a few remnant populations. But then this latest wave of wolves, they're nearly all descended from gray wolves that the federal government introduced to Yellowstone and central Idaho in the 90s. And they did well despite hardcore opposition from ranchers and some political figures. And these are their descendants now dispersing into California.
And President Trump took the wolf off the endangered species list, though it is still a crime to kill a wolf here in California, right? And if you do, you face a very stiff penalty, $100,000 fine.
Yeah, the wolves got protected under the State Endangered Species Act in California. And that's the only state where they have that level of protection. And yeah, it's a $100,000 fine. Is they talk about also some prison time, but it hasn't stopped some people from killing wolves. There's been several wolves that have disappeared, or one showed up with a bullet by the side of the road. There was another wolf called OR54. She was one of OR7's daughters, and she,
I think, is the longest traveled of all. She went 8,700 miles. We know this because she was collared. And then her death is being investigated as a crime.
You spoke to ranchers in Lassen County, and they're not happy that these wolves are there. Do they blame wolves for killing their livestock?
Yeah, and wolves have demonstrably killed some of their livestock, and they think that wolves are killing a lot more of their livestock than state biologists and investigators think. I mean, the biologist I was with, he took me to this cattle carcass, and there was wolf prints all around it, and it would be very easy to conclude that the wolves had killed this cow. But wolves are big scavengers, and they are very good at finding carrion. And I think that is one cause of these misunderstandings between ranchers and wolf biologists. If they see a wolf track by a dead cow, they assume that the wolves actually killed that cow. Whereas the more common scenario is that a cow will die of disease and the wolves will come in and scavenge it.
But they also say that just the presence of wolves scares the cattle, and then the cattle don't eat as well, and they're not as robust when it comes time to slaughter them, and they lose money that way.
Yeah, they do say that. I was up there in Lassen County, and it was twilight. There was this pasture full of cattle, and the wolves came walking through, and the cattle barely even lifted their heads. They just carried on grazing. That certainly didn't look like the scenario that ranchers were describing to me. And the wolves were howling. The cattle didn't even stop grazing when the wolves were howling all around them.
Wow. And so what is happening politically then? Are the ranchers hoping to convince California officials to let them protect their livestock and shoot the wolves if they're on their property?
I mean, I think that's what most ranchers would like to do, to be able to, you know, if you see a wolf eating one of your calves, you know, the instinct is to reach for the rifle. But, you know, that's a criminal act in California. I think much as they would like to get their rights to protect their livestock back, they're realistic enough to know that that's not going to happen. So what they're asking for is a compensation program. Since they're not allowed to protect their cattle from wolves, if you get a confirmed wolf kill of a sheep or a calf or a heifer, then you would get reimbursed by the state for the value of that animal. And these programs are up and running, I think, in most other states, or maybe all other states that have wolves.
It does seem to be a cultural dispute as well. As one of the ranchers in your story points out, liberals in the cities love wolves because, well, people in the cities don't have to deal with them, whereas these ranchers have to deal with them, and they don't love them as much. They even think that there is some kind of, or some of them think that there is some kind of government plot to introduce wolves into California.
Yeah, it's very widely believed among ranchers and other people in the livestock industry that wolves were deliberately introduced, that they did not find their own way into California. And some people will say that it's the federal government, and other people will say it's the state government, and other people will talk about shadowy groups of radical environmentalists smuggling wolves into California. And there's a lot of conspiratorial thinking around the issue. I mean, wolves just have a way of inflaming people's emotions. They tend to get either romanticized, you know, often by people in the cities, or they tend to get demonized as these kind of bloodthirsty, slavering killers that, are, you know, will snatch your baby out of a crib. What the biologist is working towards is just to get people to tone down the rhetoric and look at the reality. Like, here are a few animals trying to make a living. Occasionally they will take a calf or a sheep, but the problem isn't as bad as the ranchers are making out, in his opinion.
Well, it is remarkable that the wolf does play such an outsized role in mythology, really. You look at our fairy tales, the big bad wolf. The wolf is the arch enemy in so many stories that we grew up on.
Yeah, it's also interesting to contrast Native American wolf stories with Euro-American wolf stories. And in our folklore, wolves are big and bad and menacing. In Native American folklore, wolves are seen as brothers and companions. and not as a menace at all.
So what is the future if the wolves are allowed to live and not be hunted here in California? What is the prognosis for how many more wolves there will be in California in the next few years?
I mean, I don't think anyone's proposing a concrete number, but there will be more wolves, I think. Colorado has just voted last year to introduce wolves. Some of those Colorado wolves are going to spill over into Utah and Nevada. I mean, you've got more and more wolves coming down from Oregon. You've got the offspring of this Lassen pack in Northeast California. If all these wolves start finding each other, the numbers are going to jump up and wolves are going to start showing up in new places in California and other states.
Would a wolf ever make its way down to Southern California, do you think?
I'm not sure how the habitat is. I mean, there's some pretty good mountain ranges.
Yeah.
I would think it's possible. And we'll see where this wolf in Monterey County, whether he keeps going south.
Richard Grant, his article is called The Wolf That Discovered California. It's in the Smithsonian Magazine. Richard, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, like a wolf, I am running away. That's the end of the show for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will see you tomorrow.